History is the most important subject that you can study. And if you can't see what's happening in the past, you can't look nearly as far in the future.
Okay, we've had a problem here.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
They will still say, this was our fighting power.
This is Rewind Repeat, a history podcast.
How do you imagine trade in the Mediterranean would look like during the Roman Empire time period? Many of you can get a good idea of how connected the world was back then just from reading and studying the Bible, especially the Book of Acts. I think it's pretty easy to understand that people got around in the empire. They would move between Europe and the Middle East, and it would take some time, but it wasn't unheard of, and it was pretty commonly done. But what about the time period before the Roman Empire? Say 1,000 years earlier, to a time when the Phoenicians ruled the Mediterranean trade. We're talking about the 800s and 900s BC, time period of the Kingdom of Israel and Judah, that time period. Do you imagine a world that is connected like in the Roman times? Can you envision Northwestern Europe, even the British Isles, trading and connected as part of a trade network with people that spanned all the way to the Middle East? It may be hard to imagine, but history and archaeology show that is what was going on even back then. Maybe not at the same frequency or at the same speed, but the trade network was in place long ago, even before Roman times. And so we might need to update our mental picture of what the Western civilization looked like at this time. All around the Mediterranean world, in the coastal areas up in northwestern Europe, including the British Isles, people were trading whatever excess animals or produce they grew, whatever metals they mined, they would sell and be a part of this trade network. The historical record shows that the Phoenicians colonized the Western Mediterranean and established a trade network with other Phoenician cities throughout the Mediterranean. They controlled the trade on the western side at least as early as the 8th century BC. We can see it from the historical record. There is a stone inscription known as the Nora Stone, dating to the 9th century BC. It was found in the Mediterranean island Sardinia, and it refers to the Phoenicians fighting in Tarshish, which scholars believe was located in southern Spain. Spain is important because of that Tarshish trading port, and that port was spoken of in the biblical and secular historical record. And so when you're talking about a trade network of this time, you're going to want to look deeper into Spain. And from Spain, people could travel up to northwestern Europe along the coast and into the British Isles. Scholars are interested in Spain, though, for looking for evidence of that trade network, seeing how developed it was. For example, there are silver and copper mines that were found in Spain that date to before 900 BC that show exactly what I'm talking about here, a complex advanced trade system. Archaeologist Dr. Sean Kingsley was researching in this area in the Rio Tinto mine that's in Andalusia, Spain, examining Phoenician records, looking for evidence of Solomon's trade network. The Bible said that Solomon had a vast trade network supported by the Phoenicians, and that it resulted in bringing in much gold and silver into Israel, and particularly from this port city called Tarshish. The Bible records this business venture as being a successful one, and it helped Solomon gain a lot of wealth from that. And you can see that in 2 Chronicles 9, verse 21. It states, quote, "For the king's ships went to Tarshish with the servants of Hiram. Every 3 years once came the ships of Tarshish, bringing gold and silver, ivory and apes and peacocks," end quote. So that's what the Bible says. Now, Kingsley examined literature about this area from back in the 1600s and found that there's a site nearby that's Spanish called the Hill of Solomon. There is a local legend of this mining enterprise being connected to Solomon. The gold and silver there would be mined at this place in southern Spain, taken down a river to a city about 40 miles further south called Huelva, which was on the Mediterranean coast. And from there, the silver and gold were molded into ingots and then transported along ships throughout the Mediterranean to the Middle East, and most likely on Phoenician ships. These excavations included massive furnaces. They found molds for processing the silver, and all of it dated back to the 900s BCE, the time period of Solomon. So you think about what the Bible says, you think about what the historical record shows, and you can think of Solomon not only as a king, but as a big business entrepreneur. You could think of him kind of like Jeff Bezos, the guy who ran Amazon. He had the same kind of wealth, but with the power of a king. Solomon also had a shipping empire, but instead of Amazon vans, there was Solomon's ships. And that was long before the time period that we've been focusing on in this series, long before Jeremiah's time and the end of the kingdom of Judah. You see this extensive, complex commercial network built by Solomon and the Phoenicians that stretched all over the Mediterranean. And this network we're talking about would have included ports, depots, warehouses for goods all along the coasts of the Mediterranean. And you can see also from the record that this trade network did reach into northern Spain, Gaul, which we call France today, and into the British Isles. These lands were inhabited at the time by the people that we call the Celts. And we know this is true as well from other archaeological finds. In 2012, a shipwreck was found off the coast of Israel that dated to the 1200s BC. So this was a little bit before Solomon's time. And this contained a collection of tin. That tin is important because tin is used with copper to make bronze, which was the most important metal of that time. Now, you'd assume the tin would come from nearby mines, maybe in Turkey or even from Spain, in that typical trade network that we discussed. But they couldn't test the tin to figure out where it came from until 2019, when they developed technology to do so. And when they did test that tin, guess where it came from? From Cornwall, England. So we know Cornwall was famous for its tin mines even before Phoenician times. And now we have evidence that that tin from England made its way either through trade or selling or maybe direct shipment all the way to the Middle East into Israel. What all of this shows is that the Mediterranean world wasn't some disconnected place. People and goods moved from Eastern Mediterranean to the Western Mediterranean, and from there, from Spain, they could move to Northwestern Europe and even as far north as the British Isles. And of course, it would work the other way. Goods and people from the British Isles could come through the Middle East from that Mediterranean trade network. And you see this with Celtic pottery, the pottery that belonged to the people that settled in those areas, Northwest Europe, Spain, and the British Isles, because their Celtic pottery is basically spread all over Europe. The point is, the Middle East had a far more complex trade network than you might assume. And with that trade network came knowledge of distant lands, maps, and of course, migration of people. And Ireland is a prime example of this. And we'll focus on Ireland for the rest of this episode. Ireland's history was recorded in written sources that are now lost to us today, but also in poems that were orally transmitted through court bards until they were finally written down around the time of 500 CE or 1000 CE. So sadly, we don't have a whole lot of Irish history to study. Modern scholars, of course, look at these poems that were then written down 1,000, 1,500 years after they had been passed on over the generations, and they will reject most of that history as myth. those scholars basically refuse to believe anything unless it's backed up by other records. And in some ways, that's sensible because you want to verify what's written. But what happens if that record, such as a poem that was carrying 1,000 years of history in it, is the only historical source available, and there's no archaeological evidence to confirm what's going on? In that case, to ignore it would be to turn your back on the ancients and their attempt to defeat the tyranny of time and transmit their history over generations. To me, those scholars are skeptical for skepticism's sake. But not all scholars believed that that history was myth. Even back in the 1800s, scholars did believe that there is real history there, and you might find some today that also do. Here's what Seamus MacManus wrote in The Story of the Irish Race. Quote, "Here let us understand that the ancient historical legends of Ireland are, generally speaking, far from being baseless myths. The Irish people are a people who eminently cling to tradition. Not only were the great happenings that marked great epoch enshrined in their memory forever, but even little events that trivially affected the history of their race were, and are, seldom forgotten. We know that way back to the remotest antiquity, the Shanachie, or the historian, and the poet were honored next to the king because of the tremendous value which the people set upon the recording and preserving of their history." End quote. So we know that the Irish did care about their history, and those bards that would successfully pass on these poems generation after generation, they held a esteemed position in the royal court. Now, MacManus points out that yes, of course there were embellishments, but at the core of those poems and that written history that we do have today, there is real history. He wrote, quote, "The poet and the Shanachie, following the fashion of the time, took advantage of their artist privilege to color the narrative to an extent that to the modern mind would seem fantastic. But it was with the details of the story that were granted this liberty. The big essential facts had to remain unaltered." End quote. So think about it this way. Think about if someone was living 2,000, maybe 2,500 years from now, and they wanted to learn about World War II. And let's say all they had to go on was the movie Saving Private Ryan and that TV series Band of Brothers. That's what reading Irish history is like. The core of the main events are true there. The dates of the battles, the names of the locations, the titles of the officers, the weapons available, the uniforms even, all that kind of stuff. But the details are perhaps embellished. With those movies and shows, maybe you get real people and maybe you don't. But the central facts survive. And it's amazing how the central facts of Irish history did survive. Transmitting history is a hard problem to solve. Think about it society-wide. Societies that used writing definitely had the advantage. It gave them a much greater success of passing on their history to the next generations. But other societies and cultures, all they had was oral tradition. I think the greatest example, by the way, of a ancient society, ancient culture that did pass their history on successfully was the Israelites. They're the best example of that. But there is a lot of difficulty in transmitting history. So, like we said before, let's say you wanted to leave some kind of record behind for people that would be living 2,000 years in the future. How could you do that, right? If you were, say, given one of those floppy disks from the early 90s today, would you be able to even extract information out of that? So we've thought about this already. And when it comes to history, that's not even really just the problem, the preservation of it. But what happens when there are several records that do survive? Let's say someone 2,000 years from now wanted to learn about the fall of the Roman Empire, and maybe they managed to find Edward Gibbon's book on it, maybe Will Durant's book on it, and somehow a Wikipedia entry. So they've got three sources, How would a historian 2,000 years from now be able to even evaluate which source was the most accurate? Do you go with the source that was written at the latest time, because maybe they would have had the most amount of accumulated knowledge on the subject? Or do you go with the earliest written source that was closest to the actual empire? And how do you know your source wasn't revised for some political agenda? These kinds of questions come up when you study the history of Ireland. Now, there are some facts about Irish history that are important to know in order to understand how Ireland connects with David's throne. Remember, the written records of ancient Irish history are lost to us. We don't know if they were destroyed or just deposited in a place that we don't have access to. Maybe no one has excavated it, and maybe no one can. But the history we do have comes from people quoting those primary written sources and combining that with the oral tradition that had been passed on over 1,000 years by the bards. Now, the Irish historians of the 1500s and 1600s, they did have access to more records than we do today. And it's from them that we know that there existed some of these prime sources that were written much earlier. And when I mean prime sources, I mean written records that wrote down the events during the time of those events or shortly after. For example, we learn about one called the Psalter of Tara, a history that started to be written in the 500s BC and recorded ancient Irish history all the way up to 200 CE. And it was drawn on by a later Irish historian, Cormac McCullinan, an archbishop who used it, as well as other records, to write his history of Ireland in the late 800s CE. So we know that that Psalter of Tara at least was around at that time. Now, his history was titled the Psalter of Cashel, though the authorship of it is somewhat disputed, but we'll leave that to the historians to figure that one out. After that, though, after his quotes, we don't know what happened to the Psalter of Tara. It just became lost. Now, the Psalter of Cashel, which drew on the Psalter of Tara, was available to Irish historians in the 1500s and 1600s, and to guys like Geoffrey Keating, who wrote his History of Ireland, a very valuable source of Irish history. But by the 1700s, the Psalter of Cashel itself became lost. So you lose the Psalter of Tara, you lose the Psalter of Cashel, and we're just left with sources that are twice derived from those primary written records. Now, there are those poems, of course, but those poems really don't start getting recorded or written down until about 1000 CE. So anywhere from 1500 to 2000 years after the fact. But they are used by the historians because they do have that core history inside of them. For example, there's the Book of Invasions, which is, as far as I understand, is the oldest written record of Irish history that survives today. It wasn't a primary source like the Psalter of Tara, because it was a collection of these poems and stories from the bards and some of these written records that we no longer have. And it was all put together around 1100 CE. Some of that earliest source material in that Book of Invasions can be traced to about 800 CE. Now, it's not like these records that we do have don't contain some real history. Those poems are pretty concise, but they pack quite a bit of information with fewer words than you would have with prose. And with all languages, we know that there's connotation and innuendos, and so there is room for interpretation. The words chosen by the bards, of course, are packed with a lot of meaning. Historians in the 1500s and 1600s interpreted some of the history much differently than the historians in the 1800s and the historians in the 1900s, for the most part. And of course, those ones in the 1900s pretty much reject all of it as myth. But these earlier historians, those that were living in the 1500s and the 1600s and the 1800s, they recognized that they were dealing with an imperfect record of history, but still, it was a record of history. These histories record several ancient migrations of people into Ireland. The two that concern us are the migration or invasion of the Tuatha De Danann and the Milesians. The history stated that a people called the Tuatha De Danann invaded Ireland and took control of it, introducing their skills in science and architecture and other knowledge. Now, who these people are very interesting. Let Herbert W. Armstrong explain who these people were from his booklet, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Quote, Irish annals and history show that the new settlers of Ireland at just this time were the Tuatha De Danann, which means translated Tribe of Dan. Sometimes the same name appears simply as Tuatha De, meaning the people of God. And in Ireland, we find they left these waymarks, Dan's Loch, Dan Sower, Dan Dock, Dan Drum, Donegal Bay, Donegal City, Dunglow, Dingley, Dunsmore, meaning more Dans, end quote. You actually see the tribe of Dan in various places in the ancient world, sailing with Greeks and Phoenicians. The Bible showed that the tribe of Dan was rebuked for being preoccupied with their ships, most likely with their international trade. And you can see that in Judges 5, verse 17. We don't know for sure, but there's evidence of the tribe of Dan in other places as well. In the Biblical Archaeological Review article titled The Song of Deborah, archaeologist Lawrence Steger suggested that based on the Hebrew, it was likely the tribe of Dan was working with the Phoenicians to get that valuable metal trade from Spain and as far away as Britain back to the Middle East. And there's also evidence, especially at the time of Deborah, that they were involved in the Greek world. The Greeks wrote of a people who fought with them called the Danoi and Dinian. Professor Yigal Yadin suggested that this was the tribe of Dan. Now, you can get the details on these connections from the links that I will have in the show notes, but they will point to Armstrong Institute, and you can read the articles there. A lot of great details there. The point is that you see the tribe of Dan sailing all around the Mediterranean world, leaving their names in places that they traveled to, and one such place that they traveled to and migrated to and settled was Ireland. The British Isles were well connected to Ireland and Spain in that trade network back then, as explained earlier. But there was a time when those British Isles do get isolated, or at least more isolated. And you see that happening around the 600s BC. Barry Cunliffe and John Coke in their book Exploring Celtic Origins noted that the British Isles were well connected with Europe until about 600 BC when they seemed to fall out of the exchange network and entered what they call a period of isolation. So this kind of explains maybe why we might have some misconceptions about the Irish and the British at this time period. There was a point in time when these people were very well connected to people all the way in the Middle East, and then a point after the 600s BC, so in the 500s, that started to change. That change was happening at a critical time. The 500s BC was an interesting time in Western civilization. A new empire was coming on the scenes in the Middle East, and as usual, this caused great disruption, new migrations out of the Middle East into places like Europe or even in Central Asia. And this is where we can tie the threads of that earlier migration into Ireland and what's going on with the Babylonian Empire conquering Judah. We noted how Jeremiah escaped all of that with Baruch and the daughters of Zedekiah and settled in Egypt for a while, preparing to finish his job that God gave him, moving the throne of David and planting it elsewhere. We know that there are some well-known trade routes that would take people from the Middle East through the Mediterranean up through Spain into places like Ireland or England. And Ireland was a place of importance for one of Zedekiah's daughter's husband, who was a known prince. Now, we don't get these details from the Bible, but we do get it from Irish history. The Irish annals recorded an interesting incident that occurred at this time period. Here's what Herbert W. Armstrong wrote about this in the United States and Britain in Prophecy. Quote, then, in 569 BC, the date of Jeremiah's transplanting, an elderly, white-haired patriarch, sometimes referred to as a saint, came to Ireland, With him was the princess daughter of an Eastern king and a companion called Simon Brock, spelled in different histories as Breck, Barak, Brock, or Barak. The princess had a Hebrew name, Tefi, a pet name, her full name being Tefi, end quote. And remarkably, Jeremiah, that elderly patriarch, came to Ireland with a harp and a stone, the stone called Leah Fael, or Stone of Destiny. That stone was the stone that David and Solomon and later the kings of Judah were crowned on. And that stone would then be very important to the Irish and the Scottish and the English monarchs. And this was all part of that major job God gave Jeremiah. He was to uproot the throne and, as we will see, plant it in Ireland with the help, of course, of T and her husband. Now, T's husband, you could say, was actually a distant relative of the Jewish remnant in Egypt. I say distant because it's pretty far back. But there's a chronology published by historian W.M.H. Milner that showed T's husband was descended from Judah, just like those Jews and just like T, but descended through a different branch of the family, specifically Judah's son Zerah. Now, T descended from Judah through King David to Phares, the twin brother of Zerah, both of them sons of Judah. Now, if you look at the annals, this history won't be plainly stated. And every source of history we have, whether it is the sources that the historians compiled together or the interpretations by the historians themselves, in all of those sources, the chronologies don't agree with each other. But the history is there to put together. You just have to have the right premise to start with. And the right starting premise is that Jeremiah was given a big job by God to move that throne. And so when you put the Bible's record together with the secular history of Ireland and other Celtic people that we do have, we can get the full picture. The historians in the 1600s, even if they could not agree on a full chronology, they could at least come into agreement on one aspect of the timing, that there was a provincial capital city called Emania, and it was founded in the 300s BC during the reign of a king called Cimbeth, or Cimbeth. I have no idea how to pronounce Gaelic king names. This is important because the Irish sources say that this elderly patriarch, this prophet, who was a man of incredible influence, lived 8 generations before Emania was founded. And that prophet was named Olam Fodla. Olam Fodla is an interesting name too as well, because it's actually not a specific name, but rather it's like 2 titles compressed into one. Before the bards and before the Shanachies, those historians, there were Olams, or the sages of Ireland. There were more than historians, especially this Olam. Here's what the Annals of the Four Masters, which is a compilation of ancient Irish history that was put together in the 1600s, recorded about Olam. And by the way, the compilers there say that Olam Fodla should actually be pronounced Olav Fola. Quote, Olav Fola is celebrated in ancient history as a sage and legislator eminent for learning, wisdom, and excellent institutions, and his historic fame has been recognized by placing his medallion in basal relief with those of Moses and other great legislators on the interior of the dome in the Four Courts of Dublin. The Convention of Tara, called Fesh Timrach, from Fesh, which signifies a convention or assembly, was ordained by Olav Fola to be held every 3rd year in the royal residence at Tara, and was attended by the provincial kings, princes and chiefs, the Druids or pagan priests, the Brehons or judges, and the bards in the pagan times, and after the introduction of Christianity by the bishops, abbots, and superior clergy. And a great number of people also attended those assemblies, which were held every 3rd year in the month of November. The ancient records and chronicles of the kingdom were ordered to be written and carefully preserved at Tara by Olav Fola, and these formed the basis of the ancient history of Ireland called the Psalter of Tara. End quote. So Olaf Ola was this incredibly important figure to Irish history. He was responsible for a cultural revolution in Ireland, one that included creating an educational system that lasted many generations. And you can see the influence of that educational system reaching all the way into Europe, even up to the Reformation time period. That revolution that Olaf Ola started also included a legal and a religious overhaul, and especially important to us today, the beginning of Ireland's written history. Even the name Psalter of Tara gives an interesting connection to Jeremiah and indicates that Olaf Ola wasn't just interested in setting a historical record. The Psalter of Tara was a collection of psalms that would have been sung to educate people. When you know who Olaf Ola is, that he's Jeremiah, who had access to King David's Psalms, it's exciting to think about what the Psalter of Tara contained, what it actually was. Here's what Gerald Fleury says about this.
So what does this Psalter mean? Well, let me give you the definition here, just of out of Webster's dictionary. He says it's a version of the Book of Psalms, or just Psalms. So why would you call a history of Ireland the Psalter of Tara? It's about Psalms. Whose Psalms? Well, now the throne of David was established right there in Tara. And so it must have had something to do with David's Psalms.
So the primary motivation in this education overhaul was to introduce and promulgate the culture of the throne of David into Ireland. The name shows where the focus was. The Psalter of Tara, the Psalms, built around King David and that throne of David. And it also shows that in this overhaul, in this revolution, that there is a strong religious component to it as well. It's only logical. Why else would Olaf Ola or Jeremiah have named it the Psalter of Tara?
And Jeremiah went to Ireland to establish that throne, and he revolutionized that whole country. And he did it focusing on the Psalter of Tara, the Psalms of King David.
And of course, history was part of the Psalter of Tara. Jeremiah was working to get Ireland's history written down, perhaps for the first time, but it was part of this overall cultural revolution. That's what ultimately Jeremiah was aiming to do and did with the Psalter of Tara. And you can see how he was able to do it too, through this fesh, where all the leaders of Ireland gathered together for a week. Historian Keating called it a parliament, and emphasized how these reforms also affected families and even the economic system of Ireland. So you can see how important these feshes were. Though when Catholic Christianity was introduced, you can see the fesh was changed as far as timing goes. And here we see Tara was an important political center for Ireland, from which an unified Irish identity began to emerge. We don't know how much authority the High Kings who would reign from Tara had, but at this time, the High King, along with Olaf Ola, had enough power and influence to institute this fesh and to make some big legal and religious changes. It was from Olaf that Ireland's unique educational history also started as well. The Irish schools were known in medieval times as being the best in Europe, and it was pretty common that students from all over Europe would travel there in Ireland to learn. And you see this tradition where teachers were held in high esteem and where the Irish education was also held in high esteem last all the way until about the Reformation time period. The Irish annals say Olaf Ola built a structure at Tara for the learned sort of the realm, in their words. And that was translated from a poem that mentions these words, Mur Olamhan. Now, some editors translate the phrase as the house of Olam, meaning his palace. But it can also be translated, and should be translated, school of Olam. It was a school of Olam, which implies it was his school. But also remember, Olam means sages, or you can even say prophet. So it was a school for the prophets. So here you have that start of that tradition of high quality education and higher learning that stretched for over 1,000 years in Irish history. Now, from those schools, Olaf was able to educate people, and then those educated sages would also be given the title of Olam over time. And so you see how he was able to continue some of the culture and traditions of the Jews in the Middle East and the Israelites and transplant that into somewhere as far away as Ireland. An interesting connection to Jeremiah is that Olam or Olaf means the possessor of hidden knowledge, which really matches who he was. He was a prophet. Now, we get a lot of rich detail about this figure and others because of those epic poems that I mentioned before. And that was kind of the advantage of passing on the history through a system of poems. It just tends to seem to generate more creativity and also allow for those details to be passed on much easier. For example, the Annals of the Four Masters published a literal translation of a poem composed by a sage named Fintan, and it was called or titled Din Shankus and dated to the mid-first century CE, so about 500 CE, giving an account of ancient names and matters connected to that political capital Tara. Here's an excerpt of the poem, which talks about Ti, Queen Ti. Quote, "The fortress of Crofin, well applied, was its name among the Tuatha De Danann, until the coming of the agreeable Ti, the wife of Ahriman, of noble aspect. A rampart was raised around her house, for Ti, the daughter of Lughaid, was buried outside in her mound, and from her it was named Timur. The seat of the kings it was called, the princes, descendants of the Milesians. Five names it had before that time, that is, from Fordruim to Timur. I am Fintan the Bard, the historian of many tribes. In the latter times, I have passed my days at the earthen fort above Timur." End quote. So there you have what an ancient Irish poem would look like. This is a great look into the work of those bards. Now, Timur is another name for the hill of Tara, daughter of Lughaid, which is what describes Ti in this poem, should be translated daughter of God's house. Lughaid could be God's house, which is another link of Ti being connected to Jerusalem as a daughter of Zedekiah. Of course, Fintan wasn't the only bard around, and there are several poems about Ti that add various details. All of them, though, show that she wasn't born in Ireland and she came from the Middle East. The Annals recorded a poem from Cuan o Lachan. Now, I have no idea how to pronounce this once again, but you can find this poem in the Annals of the Four Masters. He was the chief bard of Ireland at 1000 CE, and he was basically Ireland's most preeminent historian, and he died in 1024 CE. He wrote this poem, and I'll take some excerpts from it. The first part described how this hill of Tara became an important political center. Quote, "It gave great happiness to the women when Timur the Strong was erected, and the daughter of Lughaid obtained a hill on the plain deserved by a lover, a dwelling which was a stronghold and fortress, the best of mounds, which could not be demolished, where after her death was Ti's monument, which ever perpetuated her fame." End quote. The poem then showed the loving relationship Ti had with her husband, and then the bard wrote these lines, quote, "Brigia of Ti was a delightful abode. It is recorded as a place of renown and contains the grave of the great Mergek, a sepulcher which was not violated. The daughter of Pharaoh of many champions, Tefi, the most beautiful that traversed the plain, here formed a fortress circular and strong, which she described with her breastpin and wand. She gave a name to her fair fortress, this royal lady of agreeable aspect, the fortress of Tefi, where met the assembly, where every proceeding was conducted with priority. It may be related without reserve that a mound was raised over Tefi as recorded, and she lies beneath this unequaled tomb which mighty queens had formed there, The length and breadth of the tomb of Tefi, accurately measured by the sages, was 60 feet of exact measure, as prophets and druids have related. End quote. So in this poem, you get the details of how Ti came from Egypt and how she was also called Tefi. Now, there are interesting Hebrew connections to the names Ti and Tefi. In Hebrew, Ti means wanderer, and Tefi is a pet name meaning beauty. So you could say Ti was this wandering beauty after she had to flee Jerusalem. Now, you might be wondering what the Celtic language has to do with the Hebrew language. This subject actually came up in the Exploring Celtic Origins book, which stated this, quote, "Over 100 years ago, the Welsh polymath Sir John Morris Jones recognized parallels in the syntax of the Welsh and that of ancient Egyptian and the Semitic languages such as Hebrew and Arabic. The idea was not altogether new in 1900, but Morris Jones took it out of the realm of antiquarian pseudoscience and the doctrines of the British Israelites. His work began the Hemito-Semitic substratum theory of Celtic, which remains credible for many linguists today." End quote. And that actually brings up a subject worth addressing as we continue this story. The idea that a Jewish princess came to Ireland and formed part of the royal line there, which then extended into Scotland and England, that idea has been labeled British Israelism. This is, of course, the history that I am relating in this episode today, but it does have a lot of critics, and you can see that those critics will use that label as kind of like a mild slur these days. But no matter, because we're looking at the history, and it is what it is. Now, why was Ti seen as the daughter of Pharaoh? Well, remember, Jeremiah and Ti were in Egypt for at least a decade, and that would have required, at the very least, the Pharaoh's permission and most likely even his protection. And so we have a princess living in Egypt by the Pharaoh's favor, and so when the Irish are trying to describe the situation for the history, what else would a princess living in Egypt be known as? Pharaoh's daughter. That is the most logical way to describe her, even if she's a Jewish princess in exile. At the same time, Jeremiah and Ti arrived in Ireland. This great sage named Olaf Ola entered Irish history, which was, once again, 8 generations before this founding of this provincial capital, Emania. Now, next we need to know the connection between Olaf Ola to Ti's husband to understand how this throne was successfully planted or overturned in Ireland. And this takes knowing the story of Ti's husband and their arrival to Ireland with some of the information from not just the Irish annals, but the annals of the other Celtic people, notably the Scots and the Welsh. One of the poems I've quoted already mentioned that Ti's husband was named Ahriman, by the way, and that he descended from the Milesians. Here's what the translators of the Annals of the Four Masters wrote about Ti's husband, Ahriman. He was, quote, "the first Milesian monarch of Ireland," end quote. The term Milesian refers to a group of people who entered Ireland that descended from a king named Milad of Spain. Now, I'm using Keating's variation of his name, as there are several ways to say this name, and I think for the sake of my terrible pronunciation, I might just call him Mil. So, the Milesians come from this king named Mil. This king was a warrior king who descended from Judah through the line of Zerah. And we see that this specific branch of descendants of Zerah spent some time in Greece. They spent some time in Scythia, which is basically the area north of the Black Sea, and ended up in Spain. Now you see the proof that Mil descended from Zerah in Milner's chronology, by the way. And this is actually critical to Jeremiah's job in the history, as a biblical prophecy foretold that the throne of David would move from a descendant of Pharez to a descendant of Zerah, Pharez's twin. And that descendant of Zerah would rule over the tribes of Israel, not the Jews, like the later kings of Judah did. This prophecy is found in Ezekiel 21, verse 26, quote, "Thus says the Lord God, remove the diadem and take off the crown. This shall not be the same. Exalt him that is low and abase him that is high. I will overturn it, and it shall be no more until he come whose right it is, and I will give it him," end quote. So we have this prophecy about this line of Zerah, and how they will have the throne of David. Here's what Mr. Armstrong wrote in the United States and Britain in Prophecy. Quote, King Zedekiah of David's dynasty had the crown. This says it is to be removed. It was removed. He died in Babylon. His sons and all the nobles of Judah were killed. This shall not be the same. The diadem is not to cease, but a change is to take place. The throne is to be overturned. Another is to wear the crown. Exalt him that is low and abase him that is high. Who is high? King Zedekiah of Judah. Now he is to be abased. He is to lose that crown. Judah has been high, while Israel has been low, these many years without a king. The Pharaoh's line had been high, the Zerah line low. I will overturn it, and it shall be no more until he comes whose right it is. What was to be overturned? The diadem and the throne. Not once. It is to be overturned three times. Overturned by abasing Zedekiah, the house of Judah, the Pharaoh's line, and exalting now the house of Israel, and one of the Zerah line. The first of the three overturns was performed as the first half of Jeremiah's commission. End quote. So Mr. Armstrong described Jeremiah's job, the timing of it, and who was involved. This is important to realize because God's word is sure, and these prophecies are now fulfilled and history that we can read about in these annals. Jeremiah did what he needed to do, and God kept his word to King David. His line and his throne continues to this day. So when you read the annals of the Irish and the other Celtic people, they must be filtered out by what the Bible prophesied and said would happen. There's a connection with two royal lines here that descended from Judah, one from Zerah and one from Pharez. There's an overturn or moving of the throne as well as the stone, and Jeremiah was the one to perform this with one of Zedekiah's daughters. With that in mind, here is the core of the history that we can know from the Irish and other Celtic annals. T's husband, Mill, had a family and a tribe that was spending time in Spain while he was becoming a successful warrior in Scythia. And Mill grew in fame, so much so he was invited by the Egyptian pharaoh to be a general for him. He stayed in Egypt for some time, married, and had a son named Ahriman. He stayed in Egypt for some time and would have been able to easily visit the kingdom of Judah, where distant brethren and relatives lived. He's also called Eochad, by the way. So he's got two different names in the annals. Ahriman, though, is a name that is much like Caesar. It became a title that meant king. So you'll see Ahriman a lot. But you'll also see Eochad a lot throughout the history because that became a popular name as well. Anyways, Mill recalled a prophecy that his descendants would rule Ireland, that the Milesians would successfully invade and conquer Ireland. So he left Egypt, traveled to Spain to join up with his tribe that was living there, and got prepared to invade Ireland. But during that time, he actually died, and so his sons, notably Ahriman, were the ones that successfully invaded Ireland. But the sons and the people were named after Mill, the Milesians. Ahriman became the first High King, and we saw that he named his capital after his wife, T. There are many variations of this story in the annals. They have different details, but what I gave you here is the basic gist of what we know, the core of the history, you can say. I like the detail that was left, by the way, that Mill recalled a prophecy, because that's perhaps another clue of Jeremiah's involvement. Who told him about that prophecy? Perhaps it was Jeremiah when he was trying to get this job done and while they all were staying in Egypt for a time. Now, this basic story is told in the other Celtic people's history, such as the Scots and the Welsh. And those records essentially say the same thing as well, though they all differ in timing. The Irish record had the Milesian invasion occurring much earlier, while the Scottish and the Welsh historians recorded it happening during the time that Jeremiah lived. And you can see this in the History of the Britons by a monk named Ninius. So many Irish annals don't have Olaf Fola as contemporary to Ahriman and his wife T, but there is one source that does get it right. It is from a manuscript called Cor Anmin, or The Fitness of Names. It was first published in 1897 CE but it's based on older manuscripts from the 1300s to the 1500s, many of which are still preserved. It functions like an encyclopedia or a who's who of people mentioned in ancient Irish history, so that if a monk comes across an unfamiliar name in these earlier histories, they can check the fitness of names to see who that person was. This source describes Jeremiah, or Olam Fodla, as a wonderful poet who ordained the Feast of Tara. It shows him contemporary to someone named Gide Algothach, who was skilled in the harp. Later on in the fitness of names, this Gide was also named Ahriman, son of Mil. So we have the connection stated here from an Irish source. Olam was contemporary to Ahriman, or Jeremiah and T's husband arrived in Ireland at the same time. Though it does call Gide Olam's son, so some of the details were wrong. But it's also fascinating to note that that source also mentions a harp, which is another clue to the family's connection to King David. It's also worth noting that we don't exactly know what kind of invasion the Milesian invasion was. Some sources say it was like the Norman invasion of England by William the Conqueror, that Mil's sons invaded with several thousand people, and while they did not replace the population of Ireland, they took over the leadership positions and instituted a revolution of the legal system, the education system, and the religious system. That's a lot like what William the Conqueror did when the Normans came and invaded Saxon England. Other stories say that the Milesians made a deal with the Danites, the Tuatha De Danann there, but we don't know for sure what exactly went down. But we do know that the Milesians were successful in ruling Ireland. The Scottish annals preserve the story of the stone coming over that time as well. And when you read those annals, you can get that from John O'Fordun's work, The Chronicle of the Scottish Nation. You'll see that the stone came to Ireland with a man named Simon Breck, or as we would know him, Baruch. Now, I won't give quotes on these sources because of lack of time, but you can find them and see that all the history lines up with what the Bible said Jeremiah needed to do. I find it interesting, too, that the Irish annals made a point to nail down that the Irish started writing their history at the time of Jeremiah. This implies that they hadn't been doing that before. And so you can see why the Irish chronology would be less accurate when dealing with the time period before Jeremiah's arrival. So we see that the Bible ended its record of Jeremiah and Baruch with the daughters of Zedekiah living as fugitives in Egypt. And we learned of what happened to them from the Irish, Scottish, and Welsh annals. Jeremiah's job was to take that line of David and the stone from which that line ruled on to Ireland, and from there, the throne of David and the line of David would continue to rule in succession. They ruled not over Jews, but Israelites, though that knowledge was lost, even though Jeremiah did his best to preserve it for us in that school. And wow, what a job that was for Jeremiah to do too. It just goes to show you that our earlier thought experiment about preserving history was actually pretty relevant this whole time. That stone, by the way, moved from Ireland into Scotland. A certain Scottish King Fergus took it from Ireland. Now, some historians say that Fergus lived in 300 CE, others in 500 CE. The 500 CE dating is the most popular one, but that is the second overturn. And then Edward I took the stone from Scotland in 1296, fit it in a wooden chair, and from there, most of the subsequent English and then British kings and queens have been crowned on it. And that's the third overturn we saw prophesied in the 21st chapter of Ezekiel. So that stone connected the British monarchy all the way back to David's monarchy and further back to Jacob. This, by the way, was the belief of the monarchs of Britain, England, and Scotland. And they held that until recently. Sadly, that royal line, and of course, most of the modern scholars, if not all of them today, reject. They reject that history, which is sad. That throne and the history it contains points to the wonderful prophecy of Jesus Christ returning and reigning from it. And that's the best hope and the best news for humanity. Now, it's hard to conclude this series on the movement of the Throne of David, that Stone of Destiny, because this history is just so remarkable. It is what I think is the most fascinating and remarkable history that exists today. But I think I'll end the story here with how the monarchy today rejects that history, because it ties in so well with how this whole series started, about how the Jewish people could not see the warning on the wall. They could not see their own nation was dying, and they rejected the repeated warnings, and ultimately they paid the price. How often, when we're presented with overwhelming evidence, do we refuse to believe? A nation could be dying, losing its power, losing its wealth, and its honor, and the majority of its people will still think the best years are to come, even as their territory is being gobbled up by invaders. This history, the history of the fall of Judah's kingdom and the history of the stone moving to Ireland, carries with it a warning. The show is Rewind Repeat after all. That stone is a stone of destiny. Yes, it holds a rich past, but it also points to a future. A future that is revealed in the prophecies of the Bible. It's a future that holds a warning of another countdown to destruction, but after that, it contains the greatest hope one can ever know. In that history, in that prophecy, it's all there for us to understand, if only we'd believe. Rewind Repeat, a history podcast, airs on KPCG.FM 101.3 as part of the Trumpet Radio. You can find this show and all the other shows on the Trumpet Radio on thetrumpet.com or on KPCG.FM. I mentioned how the throne of David and that line of David ruling from the throne continues to this day. If you want to know where that stone is today and where the line of David is ruling from it, request your free copy of Gerald Fleury's book, The New Throne of David. It will give you the rest of the history of the stone and the throne of David and how it leads right up to the return of Jesus Christ.